al tanto, que pues que querrás otros 3 meses y otros 3, entra en grupobauan.com e infórmate. Curso trimestral de Bauan. Si tienes alguna duda o necesitas información sobre cualquiera de nuestros cursos, llámanos al 91-133-5833. Repito, 91-133-5833.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host. My name is Guy Williams, and on this program, I'm going to talk about the paradox of thinkers from the Spanish Enlightenment, right? Ilustración. The Spanish Enlightenment, who are using French ideas to talk about solution to Spanish problems. When France is, first of all, France is no model of ilustración, of enlightenment itself. And secondly, these people are very busy holding up Spain as the anti-enlightenment, right? Some kind of dinosaur who has missed the boat to the future. Talking about criticizing things in Spain when things in France are equally bad or worse, but they aren't going to say that. And then, you have to take these ideas from people like Montesquieu or Voltaire, and try to bring these ideas into focus on specifically Spanish problem. It is no coincidence that, you know, many of these people were also going back to the writings of the arbitristas, right? The people who were trying to solve those same problems under the Habsburgs 100 years earlier. So that here you have the encyclopedia, which is meant to be typically enlightened idea, right? That with the encyclopedia, you don't need anything else. So this is going to be the compendium of anything and everything that history represents, right? This is supposed to be the culmination of the human spirit and our understanding of the times. There was somebody who took the complete volume of the encyclopedia and buried it in the ground, because evidently he thought that if anything happens, at least this will survive. The French writer, Nicolas Masson de Montfier, in the encyclopedia, writing about Spain, and writing badly, obviously, about Spain, talking about the Inquisition and the fact that modern philosophy, modern science is not allowed to penetrate. Only dark superstition, right, is studied there. And so that he says, all foreign literature is intercepted, subjected to scrutiny, and judged. Only if it is classified as light reading that does no harm to the spirit is it allowed into the country. Of course, what he's not saying is that France has its own index of prohibited books, and that France is equally guilty of this, all right? He's not going to mention that. No, Spain is singularly evil in this context. Well, if on the contrary, it is a work of intellectual quality, then it is burned for challenging the religion or the way of life and the good of the state. So, How is it that a miserable Franciscan friar or a barbarous Dominican has the power to allow a man of letters to express his genius, right? How is it that... But of course, this is something that Spanish writers would have said themselves, right? How is it that people who... This is true of any censor, any censorship ever, right? How is it that a person who is intellectually inferior to myself is allowed to censor my work? Censor something that this person clearly is not intellectually capable of understanding, and yet my work is in this person's hands. Okay, yeah, this is what everybody says, and this is what they could have said about the situation in France. But no, the example they're going to use is from the perennial enemy of France, Spain. As I mentioned on my last program, the Carlos III prohibited the encyclopedia and offered a prize for the best defense of Spain and the Spanish way of life. The winner of that prize was Juan Pablo Forner, and he talked about how Spanish, especially Spanish history, would triumph. You know, he said, of course, we should tell our own true story, not as eulogists, not as flatterers, halagadores, but as judges. If we could do this, we would reject foreign exaggerations. We would describe our ancestors exactly as they were, and we would see the falsity that malice has created. But we are lazy, and this encourages foreigners to tell stories that were invented 2 centuries ago to denounce us and the empire. And he is correct in this, for some reason, Spaniards have been very, very slow in telling their own story. And that even in the 20th century, some of the major histories about Spain were written, at least initially, by foreigners. It wasn't really until the 1960s that you get a generation of Spanish historians who are writing top-quality stuff. You can read somebody like the American historian Henry Kamen talking about Spanish historiography. He loses his patience because he believes that many of these people who talk about their country, talk about Spain, and you know what is true, what is false, that they're very few of them are capable of going into the archives and using original sources. That until the 20th century, most of them were quite content to contrast secondary sources or simply take ideas that they had not actually tested. Again, this also gets us into one of the big debates in history today, and talking about, well, teaching history. Should history be critical, or should it be a celebration, especially as it is taught in the schools? This is enormously controversial in the United States right now, It's divided along party lines, like so many other things in the United States. There's increasing polarization, and people calling themselves Republicans believe one thing and one reality, and people calling themselves Democrats believe something entirely different, and there doesn't seem to be any common ground, or there is less and less common ground. So that the vast majority of people calling themselves Republicans, when asked about history, have said that the kind of history that should be taught in schools should be a celebration of America, and why America is great, and why it is so good to be in this country, right? That is their idea. It's very, very similar to the idea, for example, the very first Minister of Education under Franco. I have forgotten his name, but when Franco took over, the Minister of Education, talking about Spanish history, said that the purpose of teaching Spanish history in school is to make the children feel good about being Spanish. So don't think that they are going to that you're going to try and create historians, or that these people are going to analyze texts and contrast data. No. He expresses it very well. What we're looking for is people who have that natural patriotism that is inherent in everybody and can see that reflected in the history of their country. Again, the opposite idea of those people who believe that history should give students an example of thinking critically, of judging, of looking at a text, a historical text, and trying to put that text into perspective. But again, it is possible to recognize all of the dark side of one's country and still love it, because that's another aspect of history, right? That you see so many bad things that you you start to feel bad about your country. But in the end, it is still possible to square this circle by loving a country, even when you see its dark side, even when you see its defects, right? Many, many people believe that this is also possible. Whereas, the counter-argument is, I don't send my children to school for you to teach them to hate their own country. Because this is, again, a criticism you hear in the United States increasingly. And of course, this all goes back to the question of what history is for. Now, José Fortner is saying that a king who understands the causes that made his country great, or the causes that ruined it, and the way in which other countries ruined it or weakened it, he said, the ways that his ancestors used to sustain it, the motives that have influenced its legislation, the abuses introduced by ignorance or neglect, will know what to restrain, what to promote, what to moderate, what to alter, what to correct, and what to attend to. In other words, that history is a textbook. A textbook, in this case, for kings. And Yeah, one of the things that Fournier is in favor of in this new kind of history that he recommends for Spain, he says that Spain has no need for a Descartes, like you find in the French Enlightenment, right? There is no need for a Spanish Descartes. And he says there is no need for a Spanish Isaac Newton. And this attitude, you know, as summarized most clearly by Unamuno, when he said, que inventen ellos, is unfortunately quite mistaken. But Fournier was the beginning. As we shall see later, somebody like Campomanes, much more interested in creating institutions like the Amigos del País, right, or the Academia Real de Historia, institutions that would foment this new idea. And then finally you get somebody like Jovellanos who believes that looking at history in terms of battles and wars and plague and things like this, right, the rise and fall of individuals or kings and so forth, that this is perhaps a mistake. And in this, that makes Jovellanos a sort of a progenitor, right? A prototype of the history of a longue durée, the long duration of a school of history that was very prominent at the beginning of the 20th century in France. People that will tell you that the wars, the personalities, the individuals, what happens when, which is how we normally think of history, that is all kind of superficial. That is epiphenomena. What we need to look at is the slower changes, right? Tectonic changes from below. So, in other words, typical example, in the 20th century, you had England as a maritime power and an industrial power. And then suddenly you have Germany as an industrial power that wants to become a maritime power. So very, very quickly, Germany gets a navy, a big navy. And it's only a question of time before England and Germany become rivals and fight a war. Meaning that the First World War and the Second World War were inevitable. That there's nothing that you could do about it. This was economics. This is geoeconomics. These are larger phenomena. So that when you do study the Second World War, I mean, you could talk about Hitler. You could talk about Churchill. But that's not the real thing. That's not the important thing. That's not what's really going on. The truth runs much deeper than that. And so this is something that you do see way back in the Spanish Enlightenment with Jovellanos. And as I mentioned earlier, somebody like Campomanes, who became the director of the Spanish Royal Academy of History in order to cultivate history, to purify and clean inventions that, meaning stories, made-up stories, that attack Spain. And he was the director of the Royal Academy. He was also responsible for reading and publishing the writings of the Arbetristas. I talked about them on an earlier program, but the people in the 17th century who had all sorts of ideas about how to make Spain work. Back then, of course, they would write for the court, and the court paid no attention to them, especially in the later times when you had El Hechizado, right? You had Carlos II, and things were very, very bad in the palace. And when things are bad in the palace, the country and the empire is simply neglected. And yes, one of the most obvious things that he advocated, and which later turned out, you know, to have a very, very strong influence on the Spanish economy, was opening up trade, opening up the American market to all of the subjects of the crown. Castilian crown initially, but all Spanish subjects, so that the old way of a monopoly through the Casa de Contratación, through first Seville, later Cádiz, that was abandoned. And this had an enormous stimulating effect on commerce, the maximum beneficiary at the time being Barcelona. So that, toward the end of the 18th century, Barcelona, because of its connections with the New World, especially Cuba, a lot of that money was coming in and being used for industry. One of the most advanced textile industries. And of course, this would be impossible without, well, first of all, without sugar plantations. Sugar plantations in Cuba with slavery, with slaves as the labor there. That was a source of enormously lucrative source of income, but also cotton. Cotton at this time, there was a cotton revolution at this time. And believe it or not, one of the great products was brandy, a product of distillation. This was exported and it was produced there, exported, and brought in quite a bit of money as well. And as we're talking about the Enlightenment, and Spaniards in the Enlightenment, we really have to mention Jovellanos, right? Melchor Gaspar de Jovellanos from Gijón, from the fishing neighborhood, Cima de Villa, and studying in Oviedo, in Alcalá de Henares, initially with the vocation for clerical, right? He wanted to be a man of the cloth, as we say in English. He wanted to be a priest. But afterwards, you know, when he in his youth, he decided that he did not have the calling. Now, after that, he traveled extensively within Spain and ended up in Seville, in Sevilla, as a judge. This, when he was only, in his early 20s, this became a very, very important, a formative part of his life. He was the Asturian in Seville, at a time when, remember that Seville was it was the gateway to the New World. And it was a place of relatively progressive ideas. So that, for example, his friend at that time, somebody who influenced him deeply and whom he influenced deeply was none other than Pablo Olavide. And by the way, both Jovellanos and Olavide are going to be the target for the Inquisition a little later. The Inquisition, which at this time was politically manipulated. In other words, if you had a powerful enemy, that is when the Inquisition would try to stop you. All right, I have to take a break. I'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Profesionales de su empresa no comunican eficazmente en inglés, su empresa no necesita clases de inglés. Su empresa necesita una solución y la necesita urgentemente. Muchas son las empresas españolas que despilfarran el dinero contratando clases de inglés a diestro y siniestro. Café para todos y resultados para nadie. Dominar el inglés requiere enfoque, esfuerzo y un plan. En Baugen Empresas tenemos un plan hecho a medida para su empresa. No nos interesa vender clases, nos interesa conseguir soluciones. Y para ello tenemos un apasionado equipo de profesores formados meticulosamente en el método Baugen. Llama al 911-335831, 911-335831. Su empresa necesita una solución y la necesita urgentemente.
Hey, have you heard about our trimestrales? No? Well, let me tell you all about them. The program lasts 3 months. Eso es, dura 3 meses. Many different timetables to choose from. From Monday to Friday, Saturdays in the morning. And you'll have plenty of homework. And your teacher will correct your homework and check it to make sure you're making progress. Find out more now. Our trimestrales at Vaughan. Small groups, only 4 to 6 students per class. And the class is focused on speaking and using the language. Contact us and find out about trimestrales with one of our dynamic Vaughan teachers. You won't regret it. No te arrepentirás. More information at GrupoVaughan.com.
Sin prisa pero sin pausa. This is the Spanish expression that I use when people ask me what they should do with their children concerning English. Sin prisa pero sin pausa. The target date for English mastery is age 23. Children and adolescents don't need English, really, until they reach adulthood, until they finish their studies and start looking for their first job. This is usually at the age of 23. If they don't know English well at this point, they are in trouble. They have a problem, an important problem. If they don't know English well at the age of 23, when they enter the labor market, they will probably never reach a decent level, a good working level of English. So, as a mother or father, you need to make sure that your children gain a good command of English by the age of 23 at the latest. This means that when the child is born, you have 23 years to solve the problem. Are you capable of solving a problem if you have a 23-year window to solve it? I hope so. Here in Vaughan Systems, we provide kids, children, with dynamic verbal access to English starting at the age of 4. We expose the children to the native sound of the language, and we work especially hard to promote effective listening comprehension and to make the language fun and attractive for the children. Entrust your children to us, little by little, slowly but surely, sin prisa pero sin pausa. We will transform them into bilingual adolescents and prepare them for age 23. Contact Vaughan Jr.
Más información sobre la línea Junior de Vaughan Systems en el teléfono 91-133-5832. 91-133-5832.
Sí, dígame.
Ahora tu profesor Vaughan desde tu casa, la oficina. Tu profesor Vaughan en clases telefónicas. Ahora más fácil y cómodo. Consigue uno de los tres planes de formación en grupovaughan.com/clases telefónicas.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host. My name is Guy Williams. And on the first part of the program, I was talking a little bit about the Spanish Enlightenment, right? Ilustración. And some of the most representative people. So, yes, José Forner. I was talking about Campomanes. And now Jovellanos. Jovellanos spoke about his childhood in Gijón, and how he, well, the promise that he showed as a young man, first in Oviedo and then in Alcalá, in the universities there, sponsored by bishops, with the idea that he was going to become a priest, that he was going to take religious vows and go into the orders. Well, he decided that that was not for him. The next thing we know, he is in Sevilla, and there, a friend of Pablo Olavide, right? Olavide is the one who tried to benefit from the desamortización and the expulsion of the Jesuits, right? He took some of their property, and he is the one who began to foment those different towns in the Sierra Morena, right? La Carlota and so forth, and other derelict places, other abandoned places in Spain. Like, in the Delta del Ebro, right? The San Carlos de Rápida, and other places, using money and objects left behind by the Jesuits after their expulsion. This is going to make him the target of the Inquisition. When he is politically weak, when he no longer has powerful friends at court, the Inquisition will get him, right? This at a time when the Inquisition was clearly politicized. And so many things were changing that the old guard were waiting when people's stars fell, as they inevitably did. If you have a powerful sponsor, as long as you have a powerful sponsor, you are untouchable. But if that patronage goes away, then the Inquisition will come, as we will see in the case of Jovellanos as well. By the way, talking about the Inquisition, I live in Madrid, and near the part of Madrid where I live, right in the barrio de Argüelles, famous, of course, because of his role in La Pepa, in the Constitution of 1812. Now, the neighborhood, the area built there, must have been planned by somebody with a sense of humor. Because the place of the El Quemadero, right? The place where heretics were burnt by the Inquisition is now called Ruiz Jiménez, who, of course, was one of the most prominent victims of the Inquisition, right? And then right near there, there's a street called Galileo, who also had his problem, And not far from there, you have the Plaza Olavide, right? Another person who had problems with the Inquisition, who was incarcerated by the Inquisition. Now, I haven't gone further, but I'm sure if I investigated, I would find all sorts of little clues and guiños, no? Little winks by somebody, historical winks, talking about the Inquisition in that area, in Argüelles and Chamberí as well. So, Jovellanos started as one of the members of the Sociedad de Amigos del País in Seville, wrote things about, for example, the abolition of torture in interrogations. This, obviously, not something that the Inquisition wanted to hear. Legal procedures in terms of interrogation of suspects. Again, at the tender age of 24. His potential was recognized very, very early, and they called him to Madrid very quickly. This, basically, at around the same time that the Declaration of Independence was being signed in what was then finally going to be the United States, the beginning of the War of Independence, American Independence, the time that Carlos III is considered Madrid's best mayor, right? The Puerta de Alcalá was being built. In terms of geopolitics, Spain was very interested in keeping what is today the west coast of the United States, right? The area around California, Oregon, keeping it out of British hands and especially out of Russian hands. And so, what, 1776 was the year that Los Angeles was founded. I recently read a history of California saying that Junipero Serra and the series of missions in California, that all of that was secondary. The real purpose of the foundation of California was the presidios, establishments there with soldiers, right? Places like Los Angeles, places like Monterey, San Francisco. Now, his time in Sevilla had been well spent. At this point, Jovellanos was reading in English. I imagine he also read in French at that time, but very few people could read in English the way he could. And one of the things he was reading was precisely the work of Adam Smith. Adam Smith talking about the nature of free enterprise and capitalism, and this is going to really deeply influence Jovellanos, right? Adam Smith is talking about the end of this mercantile idea, the relationship between colonies and their mother countries, how the colony doesn't necessarily have to be subordinate to the mother country, that both can benefit. And so Madrid is an entirely new experience for him, opening his eyes. He was living very, very close to the Academia de Historia, right, in and the Academia de Bellas Artes and the Academia Real de la Lengua, all of them. He was living in the Carrera de San Jerónimo, and he was a member actively participating in the Sociedad Económica Matritense de Amigos del País. So he had gone from the version in Seville to the version in Madrid, which, by the way, still exists. It's in the Torre de Lujanes. In any case, all of this and his experience with the ideas proposed by Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations, all of these were central to his Informe sobre la Ley Agraria, which he had been commissioned by the Amigos del País to write. This is considered one of the very most important of the writings in Spanish, enlightened writings in Spanish. And of course, all of this idea of despotismo ilustrado, right? Enlightened despotism that Jovianus would have favored. All of this works if you have a king who is either an enlightened despot or who simply favors enlightenment. In other words, puts the right people in charge. And Carlos III was that sort of person. Evidently, he detested the court life. The Spanish court at that time was considered by far the most boring in Europe. He was Madrid's best mayor, right? Changing the city, changing the infrastructure of the city. But at the same time, in terms of the court and court life, so that, in the transition, los Borbones, cuando lleguen, the Bourbon, well, Felipe V, just detested Madrid and couldn't stand the idea of living there. This is why, of course, the palace was built in La Granja, right? To get, just to get out of this dirty, ugly, smelling city. La Granja was supposed to, it was like an Italian version of Versailles, right? You have, like Versailles, you have all of those fountains and those gardens. But the idea behind it is Italian. Absolutely not Spanish. Now, Carlos III, the enlightened monarch, right? The one, again, he loved hunting. He did not take his job that seriously. And yet, he put the right people in charge. But all men are mortal. And he died in 1788. His son took over. And the son was not like the father. And so this whole idea of enlightened despotism is only as good as the despot. So yeah, you have Carlos IV, who he has impeccable taste, right? He, in terms of palace decorations and architecture and, well, especially his fascination, fixation on clocks, and there's something like 3,000 clocks in his collection, so that whenever you go to the royal palace, any of the royal palaces, any of the royal property in Spain today, you will see clocks everywhere. The incredible thing is that most of those clocks work. So that Spain right now must be the place in the world that gives employment to clockmakers and people who repair, love, and understand old clocks. There must be dozens, if not hundreds, of those people at work on this clock collection. And while he was involved in that, you had, at the highest level, the person from Castuera, right, in Badajoz, young, extremely young, what, 25 years old, a simple guardia de corps, right, a bodyguard in the cuartel de Conde Duque in Madrid, propelled from nothing and transformed into everything. Talking about Manuel Godoy. Now, Godoy is now in charge. And without sponsorship, without a patron, a powerful patron, somebody like Jovellanos is lost. Godoy becomes the first dictator, let's put it that way, of modern Spain. And in his corruption, because he was corrupt, right? His moral standards were very, very low. And really could not stand, could not tolerate anyone around him who had higher standards than his own. He did not want to be judged. He did not want to be anything other than obeyed. Let's put it that way. And Jovellanos was definitely, definitely in the way. So right from the beginning, Jovellanos, at the age 48, was sent back to Asturias so that, ostensibly, so that he could study coal, carbon, and other things up north. But this was un destierro, right? He was banished from the court, banished from Madrid, and Godoy would have been very, very happy to see him get ill, or, you know, simply go away, vanish. So, up there in the north, again, starting in his, what, 50s now, he begins the Real Instituto Asturiano de Náutica and Mineralogía, which is currently called the Instituto Jovellanos, right, in his name. He starts that, but he's still in the way. In English, we talk about giving somebody enough rope. You give somebody enough rope so that that person can hang himself, right? Soga suficiente como para ahogarse. In other words, you give a person a promotion, or you give a person a chance to do something knowing that that person will fail. But that was, well, in fact, it was plan B. Plan A was to get this person out of the country. They, Godoy named him ambassador to Russia, which, of course, was, again, as close to Siberia as he could send him. But Jovellanos said no. And he had to fight to say no. So yes, plan B was giving him this freedom in order to fall on his face, right? Telling him to do something that would make him impossible. That he was going to create powerful enemies almost immediately. And he would be a demonstration of how the Ilustración, right? The Enlightenment could not succeed in Spain. So yes, Godoy put him in charge of Gracia y Justicia, Ministro de Gracia y Justicia. This at a time when lots and lots of thinking people believed that that represented a change. And when equally, people who were reactionary, people who were absolutely determined that there should be no change. So, in increasing polarization, this person has to find a middle ground, find a way to satisfy everyone, and that is going to be absolutely impossible. Godoy considers him an enemy. There is an assassination attempt, right? Somebody tries to poison him, and he can't do it. He wants to go back to Gijón. Now, in the year 1801, when he is 57 years old, early in the morning, soldiers come. Soldiers come to the door, and they have orders for his arrest. He is going to be taken immediately to Mallorca, to the fortress of Bellver, which is, again, insalubrious, which is not, he won't do well there. And everybody knows that he is frail. He is fragile in his old age. And yes, he is taken, the transport at that time, very, very bad, taken along these terrible roads, 36 days before he gets to the coast, and then, of course, by sea, degraded at every turn. He writes letters to the king, imploring him to stop this, right? And then saying, of course, saying, cualquier juicio que contra mí se haya de instaurar, que sea no ante comisionados, right? O juntos particulares. What he wants is a fair and public trial, so that this will not be like the lettre de cachet or the Star Chamber in England, that it be open. Now, none of these letters reached the monarch, right? None of these letters went as far as Carlos IV. And finally, well, he had to... He was there for the longest time. Finally released by Fernando VII. Now, what happened subsequently? Well, the French needed un afrancesado, right? They needed somebody to cooperate with Joseph Bonaparte, with Napoleon's brother. And they were looking for Jovianus to do that. They wanted him to be the front man, right? They wanted him to be cooperative. And he was not. He finally finds his way to Cádiz. He's trying to get back to Asturias. The ship he's on crashes, right? It goes down. It sinks. He is in Galicia, and the locals there do not like him or trust him. He finally makes it back to Oviedo, which has been destroyed by the war. And there, he isn't going to be able to stay. He's trying to run away. He gets on a ship and this is when he dies. A miserable death for so brilliant a man. And again, this is the downside, as I say, of the enlightened despot, right? The idea that, with a strong man in power, you can actually progress. That people, rather than institutions, will give you a better future. Because, in this case, Godoy, as an enemy, was too strong for him. All right, I've run out of time. Thank you for listening, and please, listen to my next program.
Nuestro curso online es único por una sencilla razón. Nuestros profesores son los mejores del mercado. Richard Vaughan, Ximena Holiday, Kyle Miller, Alberto Alonso, Richard Brown, nuestros All Stars desde cualquier lugar. Por menos de 30 céntimos al día. Quédate en casa y aprovecha para poner en forma tu inglés. Entra en la web cursodeinglesonlinevaughan.com e infórmate. Pruébalo durante 2 semanas y si no te gusta, te devolvemos el dinero. cursodeinglesonlinevaughan.com, porque hay muchos. Pero solo uno de Vaughan.
¿Quieres recibir clase conmigo? Pues si quieres, tienes 200 horas de clase de inglés gratis en RTVE.